Now, I've deliberately left the choosing of the selection to be preached to the preacher. So last week we had Mark's Gospel, and this week we also have Mark's Gospel. So if you'd like to open up to Mark chapter 5, Leon will come and preach. After he's preached, we'll have a time for a quiet reflection, and then we'll have a question and answer time. So Mark chapter 5.
You'd think that someone who gets to work in a church for a living that by now I'd be used to standing up in front of people and addressing them. And I've got to tell you that the very thought of tonight put a knot in my stomach. I found myself preparing and a lot ticking through my mind. I was thinking about you, not really knowing who you were, realizing that you, for the most part, don't know me. And I doubt that we've got much in common, perhaps. My background, my upbringing, my interests, my views, my values. If I were to tell you them all, I'm not sure how many of them you would relate to. Perhaps some of them you would even think antiquated. I do know that this evening, though, I'll be preaching to preachers. And that'll make you self-conscious in the pulpit, if anything will. What do they expect? What do they hope to learn? What could I possibly pass on to them? Will they like me? How will they critique me? Because I know they'll critique me. So you only have to spend a couple of minutes thinking through those kind of questions and you'll get that knot in your stomach. And then I was thinking about who else would be in the room, if anyone. It's an awful thought, isn't it? Keenly aware that the event was in honour of David Cook's 25 years as principal in this place, I knew that at very least he would be in the room. The preaching giant. So now I'm sick in the stomach and self-conscious and intimidated at the very thought of it. I must say that I'm glad that the rest of you are here, though. And it isn't just David and me in the room, because then I'd be gut-sick, self-conscious, intimidated and a little uncomfortable. Actually, a lot uncomfortable, preaching just David and I. Imagine that. But here you are, and you're listening. And I don't want you to hear what I've just been saying and the gut sickness and whatever and feel sorry for me. Really, it's nothing. I've felt a lot worse than this. Believe me, a lot worse. This knot in my stomach this evening is minuscule in comparison to what it was when my daughter was held up in a room in our house dying. That's gut sick. Hardly surprising, then, when I sit with a blank page in front of me and a knot in my stomach this week, that my thoughts whisked me right back to that day. If I have anything to say to you this evening that might be helpful, I know it will be because of what I got taught through those desperate days. It was, to say, a pivotal point in our lives. And here's the thing, on just one of those days, everything changed for us as a family. Absolutely everything on a single day. It's a day mixed with every emotion that I know. A day sometimes I find myself marvelling at, and sometimes I find myself confused still about it. A day that I sometimes understand with a sharp clarity, and a day that scares me, and in many ways it's a day that I never want to revisit. But it's also a day that I know that will come again. Or days like it. And again and again. And I know that there's nothing that I can do to stop those days. Those days will come for me as much as they'll come for you. Believe me. It's a day that shaped. No, it's actually a day that reshaped what I thought about death and about my mortality. And as little as we might like to talk about death, we know about it. I don't need to tell you what it is. No need for me really this evening to waste time establishing your interest in the topic, because I know that death is relevant to you. Or more to the point, that you're relevant to death. He's got your number. And mine. And my daughter's. We all know it without exception. That great leveller. He'll take no notice if you're poor or rich, smart or simple, if you're old or even if you're young. For all of our diversity, death will be at least one thing that we'll have in common between each one of us. Of course, the stats on death are pretty revealing too. One out of every one persons dies. That's it. And I know that you can make statistics say all kinds of things, but try making that statistic say something that you're not a part of. It isn't a pleasant thought. And I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know. You know it. Everyone who walked past you today knows it. I know it. I know it now. I knew it then. And yet it didn't stop me doing what I did. They say that desperate times call for desperate measures. And I've always thought that that was just an excuse that people used to justify their behaviour. Until, of course, I was a desperate man. And I came to realise that desperate times call for desperate measures, and I was desperate. I mentioned to you a moment ago that my wife and I have a teenage daughter. You may or may not have known that. It seems like only yesterday that she was 12 years of age. Little lamb. My beautiful little girl. I don't mind standing in front of you and telling you that I have a deep love for my daughter. What parent wouldn't? And of course, the thing that surprised me most about being a dad was that as selfish as I am, I'd rather go without and see my little one have all that she needed. Even if that meant giving up stuff, giving up my reputation, whatever. I'd do, in fact, anyone would do whatever they could for their kids, wouldn't they? And so when she got sick, we were obviously concerned. In the beginning, you think that it'll pass. It's probably just a fever. And so you'll expect that she'll be better in the morning, and off she'll go to bed, and you wake her up and she isn't any better. In fact, all indications are that she is getting worse. So more rest, and you feed her the stuff that's going to help if she can keep it down. Get a doctor. You'll do what you can do. You'll have the church pray, and you'll do everything, and we did. And she got sicker, and we got more desperate. And I don't know if my wife and I said it to each other, but deep down in that place where you really know what you know, I knew that my daughter was dying. If you want to know how desperate I was, let me tell you. And just so you understand this, what I did was completely out of character. Never gone in for this kind of stuff, always been very conservative, very orthodox, working, for a church. I'd heard of a man, one of those blokes with healing ministry, miracle worker, and he was nearby and quite a following. And you can be sure that he was certainly the topic of a discussion at the church. And I don't mind telling you that we were very skeptical, not just because of his healing ministry, more the stuff that he was saying made all kinds of outrageous claims. And you might sit there wondering if a person who was healing people was nearby, why didn't I rush out there the moment my daughter fell ill? Why didn't I go? And all you need to know is just how sensitive this situation is. Here is me, Jairus, a synagogue ruler, and there is this bloke, Jesus, the miracle man. And there is a chasm between us. Everything that I stood for, he seemed to oppose. Everything I'd grown up believing, he seemed to be constantly undermining. Everything that I knew about God, he seemed to be claiming for himself. My livelihood was threatened by this man. I was threatened by him. You boil it all down, and every inkling in my body was saying he's not an option. My history said don't consider him. My religion said don't consider him. My social group said don't consider him. And yet when I heard that he was on our side of the lake, I considered him. I went to see him. Desperate times call for desperate measures. I don't know if you've been there. But when you stop on a particular day and ask that question, what have you got to lose? And it hits you that the answer to that question is my 12-year-old daughter. Well, pride will melt in a moment under the heat of an answer like that. Jairus, put away your pride. So I was out the door and I was on my way to the lake to find this man, leaving my daughter behind me. He wasn't hard to find. There was a crowd surrounding him, as you could probably imagine. I weaved my way through the crowd and I fell at his feet and I begged him. I implored him. I said to him, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hand on her so that she will be healed and lived. He agreed to come. He left the crowd. He took an interest out of that sea of people in just the one. And he made a journey from that crowd to my house to see my daughter. On the way, we see the very thing that I don't want to see. It's men coming from my home towards me. And maybe you could tell from their gait, or maybe it comes from that place inside where you just know what you know. I knew that this was bad news closing in with every step. And they say, your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? It was like someone had just taken the biggest rock that they could find and they placed it on my chest. Ever felt that? And you struggle to inhale, and you inhale for the longest time. The sheer denial. No! 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 This can't be right! And so you stand there, and the camera spins through 360 degrees, and you're caught in this claustrophobic close-up. Dead! 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 The hollow echo that bounces around the mind. And then in the midst of that, I realize that Jesus is speaking to me. And let me say, at that point, he could have asked me for anything at all, and I'd have given it to him if it meant that I'd see my daughter alive when I got home. Ask away. Is it money? Do you want me to quit working down at the temple? Do you want me to pray more or pay more or be more or do more to straighten up and fly right? I'll do whatever it takes. Ask away. What does he ask? Never forget it. He asks me not to be scared and to have faith. He says, do not be afraid. Just believe. It's as if he completely ignores what the men from my house have said. It'd be worth you noticing that he invited me to move from fear to faith. Wouldn't surprise me if you were to hear other stories about that man Jesus, and if they didn't take you on that same journey. Before the men came from my house with the terrifying news, I saw a woman in that crowd that day shaking at the feet of Jesus. Shaking with fear. All because she'd touched him in the hope that she would be healed. Full of fear and faith. She'd bled for 12 years. For as long as my daughter had been alive. She'd suffered all that time. She'd exhausted every option. Her finances gone. She got worse, not better. And she was healed. And he commended her for her faith in him, that it was not misplaced. He told her to go in peace. From fear to faith to peace. And it's right on the back of that episode that those men arrive with the news that my daughter has died. And I was afraid. And I had no peace. He says, just believe. And then he starts back off in the direction of my home. Only now he dismisses the crowd. And he doesn't let anyone follow him except for Peter and James and John, the brother of James, and me, of course. And when we come to my home, there's a commotion there. There's people crying and wailing loudly. And Jesus cuts right through. He goes right into the crowd of mourners and he says to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." And those that were crying and wailing begin to laugh at him. They knew that he was dead, that she was dead. And he put them all out. He took my wife and me and the disciples who were with me, and we went into where my daughter was. And he took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha cum." It means little girl. Little lamb, I say to you, get up. Immediately, my daughter stood up and walked around. There was complete astonishment. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about it, told us to give her something to eat. I'm fairly confident that it's okay that I tell you about this now. I don't think he intended us to keep it a secret forever. Or even for very long. You know, walk outside, there's that crowd, she was dead, and probably, it's probably why if you pick up your Bible and turn to Mark 5, you read my story there. It's no secret. And I'm not even going to ask you not to tell anyone else about this. I'd encourage you to tell others this story. Because here's the thing. I saw that day in that room, that the same room which earlier that day I'd sat in and I'd looked at my dying daughter struggling against death's clutches, and I was powerless. I sat in a room earlier that day and saw my scared little girl fight for one more breath, and I was scared. Desperately scared. Powerless and scared. And see, who has confidence? And who feels powerful in the face of death? I'd never seen it in all my years until I saw that man Jesus in that room. There was confidence. There was power. A dead, lifeless corpse on a bed in a room. Death's icy fingers had snared another victim, and she is dead. And then in he walks. This death that had looked so final and so powerful, like the locked jaws of a pit bull terrier, just hanging on there, it reeled back. Death knew that life had walked in the door. And all of a sudden, like a little puppy that knew that it was meant to be outside, it whipped its tail beneath its legs and scooted out the room. Took fright. And my daughter. Breath sucked in over cold, lifeless lips and filled empty lungs. A stopped heart thumped once beneath stilled sheets, and then again and again. And blood coursed through her body and grayed cheeks reddened. Eyes blinked and they sharpened into focus. And now my daughter is on her feet. Immediately, she's walking around. We are so amazed. We're so amazed we're told we have to give her something to eat. We don't even think about that. Last thing to cross our mind. Look, I know what you're probably thinking. Didn't Jesus say that your daughter was not dead when he was talking to the crowd, that she was merely asleep? And yes, he did say that. So, which is it? Was she asleep or was she dead? Let me tell you, she was dead. The mourners knew it. We all knew it. And I've been thinking about what Jesus said too, and here's the thing. To you and I, death and sleep look very different. very easy to wake someone who's asleep. You just call out, or you shake them, or you chuck a bucket of water on them, or it's not hard to do that. Try and get someone up who's dead. Shout all you like. Plead with them. But you don't have it in you to raise the dead. And that's the point. He does. Jesus does. He showed it. His power is impressive. To him, taking my dead little girl and bringing her back to life is like waking her from sleep. He just took her by the hand and said, Talitha kum. When Jesus spoke to the crowd outside, he was right. Face to face with his power, my dead little girl only needs to be woken from a slumber. I said before that this event reshaped what I thought about death and my own mortality, and you can probably see why. See, I know that death is still a reality, but I know that it is not the thing that brings a person's reality to an end. I met the bloke who would later say of himself, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes, whoever puts their faith in me will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe that? I believe that. And I don't just believe it because my story's got a happy ending. It's not that. Don't get me wrong. I am thrilled that our little girl is alive. But one day she'll die. One day I'll die. But I've met the bloke who's got life on tap. He walked on earth, showing glimpses of heaven. Glimpses of no death. Glimpses of no mourning. Glimpses of no crying. Glimpses of no pain. And that is what my story's about. It's not an invitation for us to plead with Jesus to raise the dead for a longer life on earth. It's a story that points us forward to the resurrection. To be raised to eternal life, a life without end. Life without end. Have you contemplated that? How long is that? Well, when we've been there for, say, 10,000 years, as bright shining as the sun, we'll have no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. That long? Want to know what is also amazing? If you come to see Jesus as he revealed himself to my family and you move from fear to faith in him, there is a wonderful peace in that. Because here's the thing. That same man who left the crowd and journeyed to my home and brought life to my little girl, he left another crowd. A crowd that would have crowned him their king, and yet he willingly journeyed to a cross where he died. Where he died suffering the full weight of God's wrath for the full weight of our rebellion against God. And I of all people knew that that meant death. And he died the death that I deserved. He was buried. Died. He for me. And you. But there was life in that tomb. I'd seen it in the room. How could death hold him? So I'd have to be one of the least surprised people when the news spread that his tomb was empty and the reports went out that he was alive. That he'd appeared to his disciples and to a crowd of 500 and on, that to hear that news, well, I believe it. What do you say about Jesus doing that? I'd crown him the Lord of life, who triumphed over the grave, the one who rose victorious in the strife for those he came to save. His glories I'm going to sing. who died and rose on high. Who died. Eternal life to bring. And lives that death may die. One of his followers, a guy called Peter, had something to say about those events. He said, Christ, that's Jesus, died once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit. Now, I don't know what you think about death, or even if you think about it. But do you hear what God is saying? He's saying that death is a doorway. And that he's walked right through it. It might look like some dark tunnel, a relentless end, the obnoxious intruder. But Jesus has gone through it and come out the other side glorified. And he's done it so that he can bring you to God. It's like death is a tunnel. And Jesus the engine of a train. Not that I, as a first century synagogue ruler, have a clue what a train is. But can you picture that train? And death. And the grave may well look like the black open throat of a tunnel that plunges inside the earth. It's an unknown, fearful realm. So watch him. And fix your gaze on him. As he steams through death. And emerges out the other side into a life eternal. All the while billowing, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. Couple your carriage to me, I bring you to God. No one comes to the Father but through me. Are we listening? Are you thinking rightly about life and about death? Is it shaping you with this kind of perspective about where life is found? Now, I know that many of you in a room like this would already share faith in Jesus, like I've been talking about. And so now I'm asking a slightly different question of you. Those of you who would be preachers or pastors or teachers of others. Are you thinking rightly about life and about death? Because maybe one evening you'll be home and your phone will ring and a familiar voice will say, my daughter and her husband have taken the baby, 5 days old, to the hospital. It's his heart. It's serious. Will you pray for them? You'll pray for them. And you'll go. And you'll arrive in the emergency department. And the lady at the desk will say, can I help you? And the only thought that's running through your head at that time is, can I help them? You'll be taken into a corridor. And there is your friend. A young mum. Sobbing into someone's shoulder. A brand new dad standing there with a tear-soaked collar and a look of helplessness and confusion. Their son is dying, and there is nothing that they can do. A team of 8 will work for hours to stabilize that precious life, and for days it will hang in the balance. Are you thinking rightly about life and death? About fear and about faith. Will you at that time remember my story and remember the only one who has power over death? Will you shape your comfort to them in terms of eternity and the certainty of Christ and his resurrection, in terms of truth, in terms of life, in terms of the only way? Because maybe on another day you'll sit in the lounge room of a dear old man and he'll lock eyes with you and say, I'm dying, son. I'm not afraid. Should I be? No. And he'll say, no. We believe in the resurrection. And he'll grip your hand and say, I'll see him, my Lord. And I'll see you again soon, son. Are you thinking rightly about life and about death as you teach others? You can be certain that death will come, and you can be certain that there is life beyond the grave. I've met the one who is the resurrection and the life. And if you know him too, I implore you to introduce him to others. How foolish I would be to know what I know and live thinking that this life, or my daughter's life, or your life, is all that there is. This life is short, it is but a breath. And so I will hang on to Jesus, content for all eternity. And today, I'll live in the light of that reality. I'll let it shape me to live in the light of that reality. Incidentally, my name, Jairus, it means him who Yahweh enlightens. I got to tell you, he did that. And it's my prayer that my story has shed some light, has enlightened you on the otherwise dark subject of death. At very least, tonight, will you hear his words to me? When you face it, or when you're surrounded by others facing it, do not be afraid. Only believe.